Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Tuesday, July 22nd, 2003. Today's session is entitled Savior of the Salvage Yard, Session 2 of the Poetry and Healing Power of Salvage and Detritus, presented by Steve Ringo. The number is RIS 2003-07. Let's listen in.
Jesus, who does?
Saving.
So saving gets lots of other words attached to it or synonymous, or the Bible talks about saving in the scripture in all sorts of ways, which is a good thing. Salvation is kind of a word that, I don't know, is maybe not as helpful as it used to be. What does salvation mean? Is it my soul goes to heaven kind of thing, or is that all? Sometimes we stop there. So reclaimed is a nice one that fits in with this idea, if you can see that connection kind of easily. Adopted is a biblical metaphor for being saved, for salvation, and being taken from whatever life that was. Forgiveness is a type of salvation, I think, or connected somehow, being freed. Huck Finn, sort of liberation theology, freedom, that's definitely part of the saving acts of God. If you look at the Exodus and Babylonian captivity and all those things, that being freed is very much a part of that rescue we touched on. Atonement, another older word that maybe has less of the power it once had. I don't know.
Redemption,
there you go.
Yeah. We had a great experience one Good Friday of going to recycle some stuff and bring it to the Redemption Center.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Hey,
so they actually called it the Redemption
Center. Yeah.
That's great.
Recycle, that's a very contemporary word. And we are recycled. And the items that you have are being recycled and used for something else.
So recycling is it?
In the cycle.
Redemption is even stronger, but kind of something similar, isn't it? Yeah. This one here has not been, I might want to finish this, I might not, but it need to be welded. But this is from above at the mine. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to like any of that. I tell people that a lot of people this kind of scratch your head sort of thing, and that's fine. But like I mentioned to Jackie before the session, you find your own way, what kind of things or relationships or relations with the animal world or relations with things or nature or poetry or film or whatever it is in this whole world of the created order that we looked at yesterday, where do you do your salvaging? Where do you do your reclaiming? This is just my way. And odd as it might be, or maybe you like it, maybe you don't, that's not the real point. The point is, how does God reclaim things around me and your own life? And what are those things, and how does that bring healing to you and to those around you? Because I think when healing happens in anybody, it becomes infectious, which is sort of mixed metaphor, right? But I did that on purpose. Today I had a little reclaiming thing, and I didn't plan to do this. My mom was here last week, and she left Friday, and she asked me before she left, said, because we have the digital camera, they don't. She said, take a few pictures of that old mine building, the spindly one that's all, just the frame is left, because I wanted, she does some painting. And she's struggled a lot, maybe more than most people I know, with 9/11 and the events of that and whatnot. And she's tried to do some paintings with that, but this building, she made a connection to the towers and said, this reminds me, and if I had some photos of that, maybe I could do to jump off from that as a skeleton of some painting to do. And now, isn't that healing for her, and might be healing for someone else that sees that? That's a way of redeeming something that was very hateful, something that's very destructive and murderous and all sorts of the negatives, but maybe there are ways, in small ways, one person at a time, that you can do that. Anyway, when I went there to take the pictures of the mine, because the early light's a little better, I was standing above that kind of old, it either is an old fallout shelter, there's a rounded concrete top right on the, when you go down the road and turn over the bridge to go to the mine, the covered bridge. It's either an old fallout shelter or kind of a septic area that is not.
Doesn't it have a door on it?
Yeah. Anyway, I saw this and I thought, wow, seen my slides, but Christine had asked me to paint something. This on the back had, this had on four or five rotted planks like this on it, so I had two of them came off right away, and then the other two I took it to the carpenter shop and ripped those off and tried to not get tetanus. And there you can see a lot of nails left here. So that was part of the reclaiming right there, rescuing maybe, if you will. And I don't pretend to be Mr. Cool about that. It's just kind of a relationship. Maybe I befriended this thing as much as anything. And then I thought maybe this would be a good frame or a base. I look for bases on which to put things, like eventually this thing might be a base or a background or a frame. So I had to, I jerry-rigged a newer 2x4 or 2x6 behind that and loosely mounted this. I don't have my tools to make it a permanent thing, but maybe that's okay too. And I don't know what else, I don't feel like it's quite done, but sometimes you gotta do something and then live with it for a while and see if you like it or you wanna move it or add something. Anyway, the point isn't the piece as much as when I didn't use any new nails. So when I put the new board in, I straightened the rusted nails that were already there and pounded them. And so I felt like, wow, these nails have been sitting there for how long? 40 years, maybe 50. And they haven't been used for a while. Now they get to meet some new wood, and maybe that's all right. But it was kind of fun. If that gives you pleasure, that might give someone else pleasure, and it maybe is a way of even honoring God, because God's the creator and the redeemer of all of it. Maybe? Comments? Thoughts? I think you're with me.
The reclaiming, using atonement, mm-hmm. and think of that as breaking apart as at one with, being at one with. Mm-hmm. The reclaiming causes us to be at one with God. Yeah.
I've heard that one before, and I've heard some even pretty highfalutin theologians use that one. So it's not just a handy little device inside the word. I think there's some truth to it. The one, the oneness. That's what you're touching on. Yeah.
Oneness.
And that's part of what will come through some of these poems, I think, too. So let's dive in. I wanted to start on page 7, which is not numbered. Maybe I'll learn how to number pages here. It's the Pablo Neruda poem, about 3 pages from the end of the pamphlet you have. This poem comes from this book, Ode to Common Things, which is a title that I immediately knew I wanted, but not to mention Pablo Neruda is just a wonderful poet. I'm trying to get any Spanish speakers in here?
That's session
1. Oh, you got the wrong one? This has the Spanish on one side if you're a Spanish-speaking person, and we had 2 Spanish speakers in here yesterday that really read nicely. It just obviously it was written in Spanish, so the way it sounded, I don't know Spanish virtually at all, but I could just enjoy it because it sounded so musical. So I would like to read the first column and the second column down to where it says truth and sound. Who would like to read from there, maybe down to where it's over to the next page, to where it says hearts burn them up? Anybody? Greta? And then from where it says dictionary in that same column, maybe over to the next column break where it says tender as a fig. Anyone? Sure, thank you. And then the last part, dictionary, got to the end. Susan, great. We'll read slowly so we can save a minute. And think about the dictionary as the word, and what do we carry in on the Eucharist? I know Neruda didn't write it as a Eucharist word, but the saving word. I think there's a sense where we can make that leap from the way poetry saves us in words, in the way other things, the rest of the creation has things that can save us and befriend us and redeem us in other ways too. So just one means of saving. Ode to the dictionary. Broad axe back, systematized. When I was young, I had no idea you existed. So wrapped up was I in my own perfection. I thought I was quite an item, puffed up like a moody bullfrog. I pronounced, I get my words straight from rumbling Simon. I shall distill their pure shapes by alchemy, for I have magic powers. The great magus said nothing. Ancient and weighty in its worn leather coat, the dictionary held its tongue, refusing to reveal its secrets. But one day, after I had consulted it and cast it aside, after I had declared it a useless, outworn thing, after it had done long months of duty as my easy chair and pillow, without complaining, it couldn't take it any longer. It rose up in my doorway, growing fast, rustling its pages and its nests, rustling its high branches. It became a tree, an authentic, nourishing apple tree, crab apple, or orchard apple. And words quivered brightly in its inexhaustible canopy of leaves. Words opaque and musical, fertile in the foliage of language, laden with truth and sound.
I turn to one of your pages, stodgy, stolen, it's great, to form these symbols out of air. Farther down the page, there's storage, a hollow word waiting for olive oil or ambrosia. And nearby, there's stoop, stout, stove, stork, and storm. Words that slide by like slippery grapes or explode when exposed to light. Like blind seeds once confined to vocabulary's cellars, now come back to life, communicating life again. Once again, the heart burns them up.
Dictionary, you are not a grave, a tomb, or a coffin, neither sepulcher or mausoleum. You are preservation, hidden fire, field of rubies, vital community of essence, language's granary. And it is a beautiful thing to pluck from your columns the precise, the noble word, or the harsh, forgotten saying. Spain's offspring, hardened like the blade of a plow, secure in its role of outmoded tool, preserved in its precise beauty and its medallion toughness. Also, that other word, the one that slipped between the lines, but popped suddenly, deliciously into the mouth, smooth as an almond or tender as a fig.
Dictionary, guide just one of your thousand hands, just one of your thousand emeralds to my mouth, to the point of my pen, to my inkwell at the right moment. Give me but a single drop of your virgin springs, a single grain from your generous granaries. When most I need it, grant me a single trill from your dense musical jungle depths, or a bee's extravagance, a fallen fragment of your ancient wood, perfumed by endless seasons of jasmine, a single syllable, shudder, or note, a single seed. I am made of earth, and my song is made of words.
Thank you. The redeeming part flows so beautifully from the creation part. Yesterday we talked about the first article in creation, and this poem bridges so nicely into that. I think that the creation and the redemption are really not so separable when you say first article, second article. Whenever you make categories, it breaks down so quickly, don't it? Because it's arbitrary. But the dictionary, what impressions do you have of this? Anybody? Little things, big things, medium? words you liked, images?
Well, just that, what you were just saying about the first and second article, and the last line, I am made of earth, first article, and my song is made of words, second article,
yeah,
word
that's
made
right
of
there
flesh. Just
yeah,
that wonderful.
The word made flesh comes right there, even though Neruda maybe didn't mean it in a Catholic context. He comes from Catholic background, but doesn't infuse a lot of overt faith into his poems, but I think it's there somewhere. But celebrating the world is something everybody can do.
And the reclaiming of the wood that was the tree into the paper that became
yeah
the dictionary.
Isn't that something?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that nice? This life almost. You know, we do, and he did think of it as dead. He ignored it, right? He had this non relationship with the dictionary for so many years until what happened? It refused to wait any longer. It couldn't take it any longer. Personified dictionary, right? In the second column there, on page, the left page. It couldn't take it any longer. Rose up in my doorway, growing fast, rustling its pages, nests, a very alive thing, high in its branches. It became a tree, like you said, Jenny. And it's the life, the growing, and suddenly he was part of a growing thing, and his brain hooked in, didn't it? And I don't know, it's pretty amazing when you think of all these things in a dictionary, the words that we use, our language, all the things language does, like Susan said, the word and the earth and the flesh and all these, you could call it a sacred text in a sense, because how could we read and understand scripture or any other sacred texts without it? How could we talk to each other? The communication he touches on in that third column over.
One of the things that I was thinking throughout was that this is a translation.
Mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. It is.
And the task of the translator,
mm-hmm,
who has no acknowledgement here, even, you know, I suppose, and what it,
yeah,
in the original book that person did, but you forget about that,
yeah,
translator.
That's
and you go to these, I mean, where, for a poem like this one, especially where you have, you know, words like stodgy, stolen,
right,
storage, stoop, stud, stole. I mean, they had to really decide now which words am I going to substitute here for whatever it was that he used.
Yeah.
There. So particular.
That's true, because in Spanish those words would not just all start with an S, but an order in the dictionary.
Yeah, my apologies to the translator, Susan. That's Ken Cravenhoff. I just didn't put it in there. But yeah, I think it becomes a new poem in some ways when you translate a poem. To do it effectively and true to the poem, it's very difficult. But to make it almost has to be a new poem. And the third column toward the top, where did it go? Dictionary, you are not a grave, a tomb, or a coffin, neither sepulcher or a mausoleum. You are preservation, hidden fire, field of rubies. And then the fire is there again. Up above that, now come back to life, communicating again. Once again, the heart burns them up. Thought of the passage of, I think it's the Emmaus story, when the disciples, when Jesus appears to them, and they're all dejected and discouraged and depressed after the before they start to hear these rumors about resurrection, but it's, you know, idle tales. And then Jesus walks with them, and when he disappears and goes away, didn't our hearts burn within us when he talked to us, explained to us the scriptures, the word? And they weren't written texts then, and it was just talking. The burning of one's hearts, even with these words. That's a saving word again. Touches on Sinai over on the left there, doesn't he? And Simon Magus is another biblical allusion, I guess. The word granaries or granaries comes up a couple of times. Storing grain.
So in the Sinai, mm-hmm, phrase, he's thinking that he's getting his words right from God then. I guess if they came from Mount Sinai,
right,
the Ten Commandments.
Sort of a pomposity,
yes,
isn't it? That he thinks, I don't need that. I'm too good for the dictionary. So let's move along. We could spend a couple of years on Naruda. I want to go to page 9, which would be the next one, Shinto, the next page. This one again was in Spanish, and again I forgot the credit translate. What's that? Shinto. When sorrow lays us low, for a second we are saved. By humble windfalls of mindfulness or memory, the taste of a fruit, the taste of water, that face given back to us by a dream, the first jasmine of November, the endless yearning of the compass, a book we thought was lost, the throb of a hexameter, the slight key that opens a house to us, the smell of a library or of sandalwood, the former name of a street, the colors of a map, an unforeseen etymology, the smoothness of a filed fingernail, the date we were looking for, the 12 dark bell strokes tolling as we count, a sudden physical pain. 8 million Shinto deities travel secretly throughout the earth. Those modest gods touch us, and move on. What are your impressions here? A few connections to the previous poem, I think, the etymology, an unforeseen, think of the dictionary.
And to Neruda's poem of yesterday, where he was talking about the material things.
Absolutely.
The memories that he evoked.
A great point, yeah, nice seemed, connection.
He seemed to have connections. To go beyond, have connections with deities. I think in Shintoism, everything can have inanimate or inanimate things can have.
Yeah, I'm not trying to make any religious statements about certain institutional gods and whatnot, as much as there's a spirit here that's nice. The invisibility. I think of some of the prayers of the church in the proper prefaces, but there's one around Easter where it talks about the things seen and things unseen, the things that are visible and that which we cannot see. And her brokering was up here years ago when I came with a real wizard of a man with blending all kinds of layers of meaning and cross-fertilization of disciplines and whatnot. But he did a sermon once where he basically had you convinced and believing that there were layers and layers of saints in the worship space there. And he did it in a way of through stories where it pretty much put goose flesh on your legs and your back. And I have never forgotten that. Every time All Saints rolls around, even, it's just a torrent of wow. That in this nave, and we usually have fairly vacuous naves, they're kind of just seemingly empty space, but all of the spirits, and I don't know that, Shinto deities, and I don't know how to explain that, I can't. But there's got to be a lot more around us than what we see, that's for sure. We know that. I think Andrew Rognes's, some of the things he's touching on in his sessions are gonna go there too, with the way of seeing beyond the surface of not just things, but the invisibles too. But somebody else talk about this one too. I've been rambling here.
Well, I think this first line, when sorrow lays us low, I think when you're just sort of, when you are flattened and breathless and just sort of, the experience really is where there's just a moment where suddenly there's life,
Yeah, sure.
And these things, that are redemptive, I mean, they call you back.
For a second we are saved, when sorrow lays us low. There's a little bit of a roller coaster feeling when you stand back and look at this poem, the ups and downs. But that, what does he say? Humble windfalls. And again, at the bottom, modest gods. There's a tenderness or almost a meekness about all this, that you don't look straight at it and ask it a question. You sort of, kind of like a little animal that's creeping slowly and you don't want to look at it. You just kind of tease, you know, put your hand like this and feed it maybe. But that's the kind of relationship that often where God meets us the most readily, when we're open and listening, but not, you know, well, where's God, you know? 10:05. Again, I think it's a beautiful translation too, the throb of a hexameter. Yearning of the compass. Smoothness of a filed fingernail. A lot of it, I think, harks upon the little things too. And how those little things do latch onto the memory, the way Ginny was touching on something we talked about yesterday, but that memory takes a hold of things and almost makes them bigger than they were and maybe more important, but maybe some people say that's imagination, as in pretend or unreal, where it is its own reality. It's just not the same as what that pair of scissors what once was. Now it's something else, but they can both be realities. How are you thinking about this up there?
I agree.
She's going to have to do better than that, huh?
It was interesting to hear, for me, the different things that, the different little modest gods that have touched this particular poet, where I think we could all sit down and recall the little memories, the little windfalls, that would shut something that at the time, if there was another person involved, or maybe there's, most of these are just things, aren't they? The face of a person, I think.
The face given back in a dream,
That at the time wouldn't be significant to anybody else but us.
Yeah.
And why is that? And why does that stay with us? But it does. I don't know. It's kind of invokes those things.
Some of them take you to people, though. The key that opens a house is going to be a person there, I suppose. But there's a double.
Just like it's modest things from modest gods.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Becoming evil.
Mm-hmm. I like the way you said that. Let's go flip the page over to Creatures by James Tate. Get a little bit more. This is got some more humor, a little different tone. Someone want care to read this one? Marlene?
Creature. The kids were playing in the barn. They trapped a rat and were poking it with a rake and a broom. The rat was racing back and forth, and occasionally standing up on its haunches. They knew it was okay to kill the rat because rats ate the grain. The rat would stop and stare at them as if pleading for mercy. Horton landed a good whack, and the rat was dragging one of its hind legs now. Then Theo clobbered him. He was an easy target now. Let's stop this, Horton said. Rats have to be rats. They didn't choose to be rats. This guy right here might be the Mother Teresa of rats, or the Muhammad Ali of rats, or the Franklin Roosevelt of rats. And who are we? Little nobodies with a rake and a broom. And with that, they left the barn and headed down to the pond for a swim. One of the ducks was quacking, quacking, quacking. Frank Sinatra, Theo said.
Okay, James Tate's he's a little strange. And this one's actually a little more accessible than some of this. I think he's at Amherst or somewhere. Near there. He was a major influence on my thesis advisor, so she introduced me to his poetry, and I just fell in love with James Tate's poetry. But anyway, What do you make of this? I think there's something about creation, the word creatures links directly to the word creation, but then there's something about redemption and the need for redemption and salvation and freedom and rescue. There's a sadness and a viciousness here, but there's maybe a slight bit of hope at the end. Somebody saw a little bit, somebody in this poem saw things a little differently by the time it was over. The rat isn't going to make it. He figures limping along is, it's pretty much prey for a hawk or something, but or badly enough wounded, but so that's not going to happen. The rat's going to die. Mercy, pleading for mercy, trapped, you know, not free, right? It was okay to kill the rat. Why is it okay? Because rats eat the grain. So there's a farm, and if you're a farmer, that's true. That's probably a value you kind of have to go with as a farmer. You protect your grain. There's some food chain sort of thing or whatnot. But I think he throws that in there as in a man's human rationale for killing.
Or usually the cat would do it, you know, so.
Yeah, the cats are supposed to do that. Good point. Maybe that is another poem you got to write.
I guess so.
In response to this one. That it takes a turn in the middle there where it starts to get sort of unreal, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's not realistic to me that kids would say that or stop.
No, I don't think so either. He goes on these fancies, and a lot of his poems he'll just take a... He'll even put voices, in, not even in a personification way, he just starts, the animals will start to talk, just, and it becomes fantastical. So that's kind of his methodology. But yeah, it just gets, it's too sermonic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It even sounds like a sermon. Who are we?
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice to think, I don't know what age the kids were, but it'd be nice to think that they would have that much realization. And while they're redeeming this animal into some human figures, they're the ones that are redeemed by stopping. It is sad, I think, but they seem to be the ones that have been redeemed by stopping the violence.
Yeah. They needed to save themselves. Save us from ourselves is sort of one of the messages here, I think. Save us from ourselves. That we have this within us, all of us. And it's easy to say it's the kids or it's the somebody that killed a chipmunk, yeah, you know, about 5 days ago, inadvertent, but maybe not. And there's a sense that people don't think, it's mindless.
What, do you know what year this is written?
I would say 98 or so.
It's just an odd set of people that he puts together as the names.
The names, yeah, he does that. For James Tate, it's kind of typical fare. Horton and Theo, right?
Yeah, but then Frank Sinatra.
Oh, right, right.
I mean, what kid would know about Frank Sinatra?
True.
I mean, just a sort of, or Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, just sort of Muhammad Ali, maybe, and
right.
Mother Teresa, certainly.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's a lead.
Yeah.
It is.
And that's funny. I would have said just the opposite. You said Mother Teresa, certainly. Muhammad Ali, maybe.
Probably Muhammad, for boys, probably Muhammad Ali, certainly. Mother Teresa, maybe.
True.
Depends on what age the person was, the girls were, too. My family makes sense.
Yeah, I saw it as, there has been discussion a few days that I've been here about the value of the sparrows is
right.
Equal to that of the humans. That's kind of what I'm meaning now, is that the rat is as valuable as we are. I mean, it's going to be another retreat of the rats.
Or the rat.
So that's kind of how I took it, is to see the value, even in a rat, as one of God's creatures.
Yeah.
That God loves no less than he loves us.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And Theo, was it Theo that saw it? Yeah. At the end, what does Theo say when they go down for a swim? The duck is quacking, quacking.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Right. This could be the Frank Sinatra of ducks, right? So he saw something in a slightly different way, and maybe through this experience, I think that's the realization that by
had this experience, maybe he's redeemed a little bit. He's being saved from ourselves through these little experiences of death and a purported rescue or a semi-rescue when it's meant actually kind of a murder. I think the literal part does get a little out there. But take a look at James Tate sometime if you're halfway inclined, and you kind of get sucked into it if you read the whole book of poems, because he's just that way.
Does he have any religious background?
I have not. I don't remember an answer to that. If I knew, I don't remember. It doesn't show up in his work as a major theme.
Is he African American?
No. Caucasian. European American. Yeah. Getting up there. He's probably in his 70s by now. Let's go to page 5. Let's go to 3. Dorian Lux. Jean, who was here last week, actually knew this poet. She's in a poetry group with her at times. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know her too?
Yeah, I'm in a poetry group.
Jean, who was here last week. She's gone. She left the village about when you came.
Oh. I wonder. We were together.
I think it was it through Centrum at Port Townsend?
Yeah, I was going to say Centrum last year.
Nice.
Yeah, last summer.
We were afraid of everything. Earthquakes, strangers, smoke above the canyon. The fire that would come running and eat up our house. The Claymore girls, big boned, rough razor blades tucked in their ratted hair. We were terrified of polio, tuberculosis, being found out. The tent full of boys 2 blocks over. The kickball, the asphalt, the pain-filled rocks, the glass-littered canyon, the deep cave gouged in its side. The wheelbarrow crammed with dirty magazines, beer cans, spit-laced butts. We were afraid of hands, screen doors slammed by angry mothers, abandoned cars, their slumped back seats, the chain-link fence we couldn't climb fast enough, electrical storms, blackouts, girl fights behind the pancake house, original sin, sidewalk cracks, and the corner crematorium. Loose brakes on the handlebars of our bikes. It came alive behind our eyes. Ant mounds, wasp nests, the bird half eaten on the scratchy grass, chained dogs, the boggy creek bed, the sewer main that fed it, the game where you had to hold your breath until you passed out. We were afraid of being poor, dumb, yelled at, ignored, invisible as the nuclear dust we were told to wipe from lids before we opened them in the kitchen. The fat roll of meat that slid into the pot. Sleep dreams. The soundless swing of the father's ringed fist. The mother's face turned away. The wet bed. Anything red. The slow leak. The stain on the driveway. Oily gears soaking in a shallow pan. Busted chairs stuffed in the rafters of the neighbor's garage. The Chevy's twisted undersides jacked up on blocks. Wrenches left scattered in the dirt. It was what we knew best, understood least. It whipped through our bodies like fire or sleet. We were lured by the dumpster behind the liquor store. Fissures in the baked earth. The smell of singed hair. The brassy hum of high-tension towers, train tracks, buzzards over a ditch, black widows, the cat with one eye, the red spot on the back of the skirt, the fallout shelter's metal door hinged to the rusty grass, the back way, the wrong path, the night's wide back, the coiled bed springs of the sister's top bunk, the wheezing, the cousin in the next room, tapping on the wall, anything small. We were afraid of clothesline, curtain rods, the worn hairbrush, the good-for-nothings we were about to become. Reform school, the long ride to the ocean on the bus, the man at the back of the bus, the underpass. We were afraid of fingers, of pickleweed crawling over the embankment, the French kiss, the profound silence of dead fish, burning sand, rotting elastic in the waistbands of our underpants, jellyfish, riptides, eucalyptus bark unraveling, the pink flesh beneath the stink of seaweed, seagulls landing near our feet, their hateful eyes, their orange-tipped beaks stabbing the sand, the crumbling edge of the continent we stood on, waiting to be saved, the endless, wind-driven waves. It's a litany, basically, of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it gets very personal and intimate, abusive family history, sexual overtones and undertones of fears that most girls or boys have in their own ways. There's a lot of allusions to junk and kind of detritus and trashed things and rusted grass, even a weird one where the metal almost welds to the grass. Saved at the very end, waiting to be saved. I do think there that there's a lot of pain and hurt and fear and sadness and glimmers, like laser glimmers of hope, not big, not neon signs of hope, not, you know, huge moments of redemption, but the fact that we were afraid is the litany. We were afraid. And I think the very end, the death and the rotting becomes even stronger, but where is it positioned in this stanza? Where are they?
Waiting to be saved.
But where?
On the ocean.
At the beach, on the ocean. They're on an edge. I think there's something about that at the boundary of this ocean, even though that ocean has a darkness too, doesn't it? The unrelenting cycle of wave after wave, but that's the way it is.
I have to go fish
duty. Good luck. Thank you. The crumbling edge of the continent. There's something of a precipice here that has fear, but maybe hope. Maybe I'm wrong in seeing that, but I want to hear what you think about this one too. It's powerful, I think, but maybe you didn't feel that. What did you think or feel?
You're talking about the entire poem now?
Yeah, anywhere.
That there's fear here of things that I wouldn't even associate with fear. That the fear has so taken over. I'm wondering about the age of the person. What age this is.
Well,
it's childhood fears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's looking back.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know this poem, Marlene?
No.
Okay. I do think she's looking back. It wouldn't have been written at the time of the experience, but we were afraid.
Mm-hmm. So to me, it's part of the hopefulness that you're talking about. Is,
mm-hmm.
You know, when you can look back and see something and get some distance from it, then you've kind of put it in a place that's not scaring you so much.
Mm-hmm. I get the sense that she's kind of like the word thing here, that in a way maybe the words are helping her redeem and bury some of this,
mm-hmm.
but just to name it,
just
to it and to voice it,
that's right.
and to list it, and it almost becomes a prayer of exorcism, in a sense. Although, and I haven't read very many of her poems to know if that's a recurring kind of theme throughout her work, but I do think there's something about redemption, reclaiming some of that, and there's a little bit of, I don't think there's not a poor me feeling in here, and maybe that's just what she knew. You know, they say a lot of people that come through abusive, whether that's even emotional or physical, or all kinds of abuse that people do to one another, that a lot of times they don't know till they're adults that everyone else wasn't going through that same thing. You know, it was that maybe that's every family. That's all they knew. But there's so much to be fearful of in a family where fear is cultivated. Even with a very positive loving family, there's a lot of fear in being alive in this world. So she's sharing her struggle with that, but the saved there at the end, I think, does bring us to a brink of some hope and healing.
Such a blend of huge. There's twice where once fallout shelter and once nuclear dust. It's
mm-hmm.
huge.
Yeah.
Here's right down to this, some of the things like a clothesline and
right.
a hairbrush could have been used to be for beating the children. So
yeah.
she called it the war and hairbrush. So
well, didn't they also talk about in the old days, you know, lice and don't
oh,
share
yes.
hairbrushes?
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's
kind
we
of
still talk about that, actually.
It's worse than it used to be.
But here, like, we're afraid of being poor and dumb
right.
and yelled at and ignored and invisible as the nuclear dust.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, boy.
Yeah.
I wonder if she was surprised of all the different fears she came up with when she did this. It's just
yeah.
like mind-boggling
yeah.
how that just permeated
mm-hmm.
everything.
Yeah. Some of it's class issues, aren't there? There's
mm-hmm.
some class issues about society in here.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's coming of age issues that everybody goes through.
That's what I really related it to, is the coming of age.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I do it. I'm a high school art teacher, and with my freshmen, I do a self-portrait collage,
mm-hmm.
and they get on fears, and this list is small.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Compared
is it right?
to a class of
yeah.
of 25, 14-year-olds,
mm-hmm.
and this is a relatively simple list compared to the fears that they come up with are
sure.
much more intense than some of these. And but so I was thinking of that too, about the coming of age.
If she maybe tries to make the poem accessible to
mm-hmm.
a lot of readers without particularizing her own experience, but
right.
that there are points in the poem where it does go pretty deep.
Right.
I'm sure that, and I know Brett has mentioned that to me, especially with high school girls and the things that society's discussing in a slightly begun debate about what we do to girls and adolescent coming of age things that can be kind of horrific.
And some of this brought back to me, you know, oh yeah, I remember being afraid of that, or having a fear of that thing in
yeah.
the bog down there,
yeah.
or,
mm-hmm.
you know, that
mm-hmm.
beer can
mm-hmm.
crumpled up behind the liquor store.
Right.
Yeah.
The French
kind
kids.
Of brought some of that, yeah.
Getting pregnant with, you know,
mm-hmm.
ways that are impossible to get pregnant.
Yeah,
all that stuff.
Yeah.
I like how in the body she is now,
mm-hmm.
both afraid of body and of what the body was bringing up.
Right.
She talks about being afraid of the French kiss. It's sort of ambiguous. Is she afraid of the kiss itself or the feeling of wanting the French
right.
kiss?
Sure. The elastic in the waistbands.
Mm-hmm.
There's some of them that are kind of a little bit of humor,
mm-hmm.
you know, that because those are things people sort of talk about. The stranger on the bus, the underpass. Comes back into the underwear and
mm-hmm.
underpants, almost right. She uses a lot, if you go back and look at this, internal rhyme, instead of rhyming at the end of the line like the traditional poems will do, there's a lot of rhyme where the middle of the poem on one line might rhyme with a word two lines up that's in the middle of that. So I think it's a nice music to it. Let's read Fork there, and then we'll probably just have time for one more or so, maybe two. Fork. Somebody care to read that, please?
This strange thing must have crept right out of hell. It resembles a bird's foot worn around the cannibal's neck. As you hold it in your hand, as you stab with it into a piece of meat, it is possible to imagine the rest of the bird, its head, which, like your fist, is large, bald, beakless, and blind.
The imagining of the rest of the bird. We've talked about imagining, you know, how we how memory works. Ginny has touched on that a couple times, and how we imagine things, and then the fear poem, and the things that our memory and imaginations turn things into other realities. And I think he's talking about a fork here. It is possible to imagine the rest of the bird, the chicken or whatever it is, as a real creature, as an animal. And farm people used to have to eat their own. They'd raise the chickens and the cows, and they maybe would name them and maybe not, because they knew they were going to eat them eventually. Our food is never that close to us. And I think there's something about eating meat where we probably need to be closer to, is the Native American way of eating meat, or the Eskimo way, is to thank God when you hunt, and thank you for providing this seal, and now I need to eat you, seal. So, but there's a relationship there that sounds a little, you know, we like it removed. But there's something wrong with our morality about this, about vegetarianism and stuff, when we don't know that part. I don't know. It's an interesting discussion, but...
Is there a connection to that rest of the bird, seeing that whole bird, and the cannibal?
Mm-hmm.
A bit of a cannibal eating the meat?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What kind of meat does a cannibal eat, right? Mm-hmm. This strange thing must have crept right out of hell. He's revisioning, or revising, or looking at a fork in a whole new way. Mm-hmm. And that's, there's something cool about that. He's taking a piece of metal and saying, this thing is something else. And maybe we need to stop and think about what it is, not just...
Well, she said the devil's pitchfork.
There you go.
The strange thing right out of hell.
Excellent.
Imagine this devil with his pitchfork.
Yeah, that's good. And we become something else too. If this is that, if this fork is something else, it's possible to imagine the rest of the bird, but it's maybe possible to imagine the rest of ourselves too. What am I? Who am I? How do I see myself if this is me, and if I'm partaking in something with this fork?
Maybe it goes back to that hierarchy also of the animal,
uh-huh.
we being in like the
James Tate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Large, bald, beakless, blind.
And blind, that the blind thing really gets me like, okay.
He ends the poem.
Blind, yeah.
Seeing or
yeah,
not seeing.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. That's good.
Being removed.
I told the last week when we looked at this one, it hadn't triggered the... Last week this poem triggered another line from an E. Cummings poem that I hadn't thought about before. It's the... pity this busy monster, man unkind not. Or if you like, you may be familiar with E.E. Cummings, he does mostly pretty short lines. Pity this busy monster, and then man, or no, I forget, but it's man unkind instead of mankind. And then the word not is all by itself. So don't pity this, and the monster in us, the busy monster, the destructive monster that's in us. It's part of our humanity. This is our inhumanity.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of inaccurate according to words, maybe. So we use these labels that fuzz it over, huh? Let's try to do. Let's really want to do this one. We might not have a lot of time to discuss it, but let's do musk ox apotheosis. Let's have three volunteers to read stanzas. Could we do that? Marlene, you want to do the first stanza?
Sure.
I'm going to read the epigraph there from Barry Lopez, and then Marlene will do the first stanza. Who wants to do second?
I will.
Ginny? No? Third? Do I hear third? I'll do third. Musk ox apotheosis. An explorer in Iceland once terrified himself by seeking refuge from a storm in the lee of what he first took to be mounds of snow-covered earth. They were musk oxen, and they began to stand up as he walked over them.
As if from unmarked graves, the dead rose up and stood so close beside us we could smell their breath. dread apparitions from the ruptured crater earth. All unexpected, our worst nightmares made manifest. Until recognized for what they were, musk oxen conjured out of snow. The weather vane of fear slewed round from south to north, still part of a continuum of terror, but manageable now. No dire climactic shift beyond our known quadrant stops.
Far removed from this, a man rose up before us once. Death hatching like an egg, we had assumed was rock. Our maps turned upside down for 20 centuries. When Jesus, like a musk ox in the snow of finitude, seemed to add another bearing to our compasses. All unexpected, our deepest dreams made manifest a true north of salvation we had not guessed was there. Until recognized for what it was, wishes conjured out of pain, the weather vane of prayer slewed round, lost and directionless again.
We still seek shelter in the lee of any cover things can give, but our shelters now seem little different from the storm itself. Nothing breaks the surface of the ground we have surveyed. The earth, delivered of its miracles, lies mapped and barren now, only within the bound of what it holds, the promise of redemption. Fragile as that miracle incarnate of just being here at all, the beasts rise up before us, transfigured into messengers, being out of nothingness, life conjured from the icy earth, resurrection heavy in each air-clouding bovine breath. It's kind of prophetic in a way, too. The resurrection is a cool picture here. I like the way he sneaks it in on you, the Christos resurrection thing in the second stanza. Far removed from this, a man rose up before us once, death hatching like an egg we had assumed was rock. It's a Christ thing. Our maps.
I almost wish that he would have left out Jesus like a musk ox in the snow. I mean, just...
Yeah, we knew it was Jesus already.
Yeah. I wish, in some ways, I wanted it to stay unnamed and more of an image.
Yeah.
Well, I might not have gotten that.
You weren't surprised when you came to that being Jesus?
No.
Yeah. See, there are those of us who needed that.
Yeah. I think when he just does it once, I think once is okay, or Christ. The personal thing of the name Jesus, Christ is a title more than the name Jesus, I think. But yeah, it makes it a Christian poem right away.
Jesus sure personalizes it. I mean, Christ kind of keeps it more detached, but
yeah,
Jesus, like a musk ox, that's pretty...
Yeah.
Wow.
In the snow of fortitude. Yeah. There's some fear in this too, in the first half of the poem.
Yeah.
I dovetailed this with the Dorianne Lux's poem, the weather vane of fear, slewed, you know, spinning almost like an Arctic wind, round and round, round south and all direction, you know, lost, kind of lostness. Where am I going? Direction is gone, but the compass comes back through this Christ event. But then again, it was lost in directionless. The weather vane of prayer. First it's fear, now it's weather vane of prayer. Lost in directionless again. I'm not sure if that's an allusion to the Spirit and the sending out to all the earth or what, but that's tougher to explicate.
I like that. That's all about the unexpectedness of these things. And it kind of brought to me is like, you know, how you're waiting for a second coming, you're waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the unexpected that really has the power.
Sure.
And you're not gonna be ready.
Yeah, like that. And kind of tenuous too. Not just unexpected, but fragile. And not maybe
slippery.
And our shelters now seem a little different from the storm itself.
Yeah. Arctic Dreams is a great book, too. Have any of you read much of Barry Lopez?
So this is a response to the book, mm-hmm. not the...
This passage inspired the poem.
Right.
Yeah.
That's, I like that idea of the finding and recycling and making it your own.
Cool.
Where you just the idea of this experience. He didn't experience it. He just read it.
Yep.
And took someone else's words.
Dictionary.
And
text.
And responded to it with his own personal
mm-hmm.
thoughts.
I like that. Yeah. Recycling texts.
It's all tenuous, though, still, isn't it? I mean, there's not, I mean, the resurrection heavy is kind of, that's sort of the most heavy thing.
I think that's a good point. And when you look at yesterday's session that we didn't get to, the Scott Cairns poems, and tomorrow we will look at some of his poems too. He has a very strong sensibility about the tenuousness of both life and salvation. Not that it's uncertain, but that doubt
mm-hmm.
is part of our, doubt is very much part of faith, and that doubt, a faith without doubt doesn't grow and doesn't heal and doesn't, you know, the journey becomes more narrow unless the seeing is diminished.
Mm-hmm.
We need to stop here. I'll hang around a little if you want to talk, but they like me to sort of...
Did you say who Chris Arthur is? Chris Arthur?
Who is he?
I don't know right offhand. I didn't bring that book with me, so but I can make a note and look into it for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's just a poet and has a book out.
He's just a poet.
He's just a poet.
Well, he's just a poet with a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who liked this other book? Yeah.
So thank you for coming, and
that was great.
You're a great bunch of poetry negotiators and communicators and sharing.
Last night in the service, the book was